High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. Today's episode is sponsored by ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Visit their website at isaac1.org, I-A-S-I-C-1.org, to follow the science on marijuana. Friends, fentanyl is plaguing America. There is no safe drug supply unless it comes from a legal pharmacy. If you are around anyone who may be using drugs, you should carry naloxone, the opioid reversal agent. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show, submit a question, or download a free prescription for naloxone. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a criminal conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Whenever I hear about a heinous crime, I automatically jump to the conclusion that drugs were involved. I also do this in my official capacity as an emergency physician. I make a doorway diagnosis when I first see the patient. I then do the diagnostic workup to confirm or alter my initial impression. For example, my doorway diagnosis may be this person has congestive heart failure, and then I do the evaluation to prove my impression or to look for other causes of respiratory distress. After over 30 years, I'm pretty good, although never perfect. On February 1st, 2023, a fellow emergency physician from Providence Mission Hospital, Dr. Michael John Mamoni, was riding his bicycle and needed a break from the stressful job in the hospital. He was struck by a car, who then got out of the car and stabbed Dr. Mamoni multiple times, killing and overkilling him. Where does such evil come from? Media and police accounts state that the victim and suspect did not know each other. The motive, they say, is unclear. My doorway diagnosis is the suspect was high on drugs. His mind was hijacked, perhaps in psychosis. And there is a good chance the drug was marijuana. My heart sinks when I hear about such crimes and senseless violence. People don't realize that drugs, and especially high-potent marijuana, can be associated with violence. My condolences to Dr. Mamoni's family, friends, and co-workers. May your memory be a blessing. And with that, let's hear our question of the day.
Hi, Dr. Lev. I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming to our pharmacy class at UCSD and sharing High Truths with us as you do in your podcast. I'm a pharmacy student, and although I haven't finished my degree, family and friends have been coming to me asking for advice, and I was wondering if smoking hookah is safer than smoking cannabis. What do you think I should advise others?
Thank you, Sarah, for your question. I really enjoy talking to you and your classmates. It's amazing that this elective class on drugs and addiction is the most popular one for your pharmacy classmates. A shout out to Dr. Nathan Painter for putting together this popular program. I have an expert today, not on hookah, but on people whose drug use led them to make bad decisions and crime. Hookah is not a gateway drug to crime. But let's hear Monty Stiles' stories, and at the end, I will ask him about hookah. I also research hookah and will share my conclusions at the end of this podcast. Monty Stiles spent his professional career as a state and federal prosecutor. He was appointed as Assistant United States Attorney for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Idaho, where he supervised the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. He worked on challenging cases, including child abuse and murder. He noticed that crimes are often influenced by poor choices due to drugs. Monty is now a speaker and trainer on the issues of drugs as they relate to communities and youth. To learn more about Monty Stiles, check out the High Truth show notes. Monty Stiles, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you, doctor. I'm very honored to be here and have a chance to talk to you this morning.
Well, I'm excited to to have a chance to talk to you as well. Our paths have crossed multiple times, and this is the first time I get to actually have a one-on-one conversation with you, and I'm looking forward to it. You have an interesting career path. You were a prosecutor, assistant U.S. attorney, working on various crimes, and now you're a motivational speaker and taking wildlife photos. Tell us about your career path.
Well, after while I was in law school, I wasn't quite sure what kind of law I wanted to practice, except I wanted to do trial work. But I had the most amazing criminal law professor who was a career prosecutor in California. And I quickly realized that was the most fascinating area. And I kind of just made it through the other classes, but criminal law, procedure, all of that was fascinating. So after interning at the Ada County Prosecutor's Office in Boise and actually handling cases as a second year law student, I became convinced that's where I wanted to be. And because there's a lot of interesting things that happen and you get a lot of trial work. And so I started as a young prosecutor after handling other cases, being the juvenile prosecutor for a year, handling mental health cases, and then dealing with felons almost every day in court, whether they was a trial, a sentencing, a plea. And I quickly realized that most of the people in the criminal justice system were there because of underlying substance abuse problems. And I started to see myself as a prosecutor, as this little guy on a tiny ladder in front of under a banyan tree, clipping off leaves one at a time, when that was not getting at the root cause of all of these bad things happening in our community. So I asked to be able to start a task force, a drug task force in Boise, Idaho. And we immediately did that and started a grand jury for the first time, started doing wiretaps, going after major traffickers. I loved that. And 5 years in, I was hired by the U.S. Attorney's Office to run the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, which is just a fancy name for a group of investigators, analysts, and prosecutors who identify the biggest, baddest, worst drug trafficking organizations around and then investigate them and prosecute them. So I was very lucky to be part of this amazing team and be involved in investigations instead of just being handed paperwork at the end of a drug case. I was actually involved in investigations that went on for months and even years and went up the ladder the highest we could go. And then we prosecuted those cases. So over a period of 24, 25 years, I handled just about every kind of drug case you could have, dealt with every imaginable kind of drug organization. In the federal system, because there are mandatory minimums and we dealt only with those kind of groups, the only way federal drug defendants get out of the mandatory minimums is to cooperate. So I had this interesting situation where we would investigate them for a long time and get all of this evidence. But before it was done, they were sitting across from me at a conference table in orange coveralls and handcuffs, telling me everything they did that fill in the gaps, how they started, who their sources were, all of it. And it was very fascinating and gave me a lot of insight into how drug traffickers think, what motivates them, how they do things. And along the way, most of my witnesses were lower type drug traffickers and users and addicts. So I got to be exposed to all of those kinds of people and learn a lot.
Interesting. And of all the cases that you've looked at, you've dealt with some heinous crimes. Is there one that stands out that stays with you?
Wow. A Thai marijuana smuggling case involved tons of marijuana being smuggled from Southeast Asia. Very interesting case, took us to Hong Kong, Thailand, Fiji, seized $28 million, was interesting. LA gang case, gang members from South Central LA moved to Pocatello, Idaho, and began selling crack cocaine. That was a fascinating case. Just lots of them. I was very lucky in my career to have fascinating cases. Our task force, besides just investigating the drug trafficking, we always had a second goal of identifying assets and seizing them. Because when you're dealing with organized crime, if you don't take away their source of power, their ability to operate, other people just take over. So asset forfeiture was a huge part of what we did. We'd put them in jail and take away their stuff.
So you mentioned organized crime. What is organized crime? We think of drug dealing as a guy, you know, just peddling drugs in the street, or like the Sinaloa cartel. Yeah. But what do you find, especially in Idaho, like do drug cartels go to Idaho? Or is there a big drug pain?
They're cartels, but except a little bit of meth that's manufactured here, pot, all drug trafficking cases are interstate, international. So you have the ability to prosecute anybody in that chain, regardless of where they are. As long as they're part of the same conspiracy and organization, you can follow them up the ladder and go as high as possible. So no, we didn't spend any time on local dealers involved in small amounts. And even those had a source, and that person had a source, and that person had a source. So in that respect, whether they're low-level members of an organization or not, there is an organization behind it. There is a structure. People do all kinds of things in an organization. Some are dealers, some are manufacturers, some are supervisors, some are the money people. And all of those people contribute to the success of the organization.
That's kind of a little society of crime.
Yeah, or big society.
Big society.
In the case.
So you've been doing this for a long time, many years. How have these crime organizations evolved over the years? How have their strategies changed? They're more like, we think now people talking, oh, they're using Snapchat now to sell drugs. Or.
Yeah.
So what have you seen change over the years?
Technology has made a huge difference for reasons you just said. People on the dark web can order up drugs and have them home delivered. The rise of synthetic drugs, you know, instead of field of poppies or cocaine plants, these things are made synthetically in labs with chemicals produced all over the place. And there are new drugs all the time. So that's a huge difference in the way drugs are trafficked, how they communicate. Typically, in the past, when we try to figure out what people are doing, we do a wiretap. So it would be a phone thing, court order, listen to their calls, try to figure out what they're doing. Now they're communicating in all kinds of ways, satellite phones, internet, dark web. And so penetrating those organizations doing that is more difficult, especially when law enforcement is underfunded and we're kind of behind the curve in terms of the use of technology. That and the emergence of a lot of additional drugs that are very, very dangerous have changed a lot. And of course, fentanyl and the other opioids have just overwhelmed us.
Is the governance of organized crime different? Is there like one drug kingpin and a bunch of people, you know, down below the chain, or is it different? Or is it?
Well, when you're talking about cartels like the Sinaloan cartel, it's a very structured top to bottom. I don't know that that's changed. What's really different now is there used to be groups that were like typical drug trafficking organizations, cartels, biker gangs, LA street gangs, that type of thing. But what we're seeing in America right now, largely because of marijuana and opioids, is all kinds of organized crime moving into the United States, whether they're Chinese, Russian, Bulgarian, you name it. State like Oklahoma, which is a very calm, nice, beautiful state, they passed a medical pot bill, and that state is overrun with foreign cartels that have overtaken the lands and made it impossible to enforce anything. And there's just recently a murder. I don't know if it's three or four people murdered by I think it was a Chinese organization at a pot grow. And they were just killed because they weren't doing something they were supposed to. So that's been a huge change in that these kinds of organizations are showing up in states like California, Oregon, Washington, and even places like Oklahoma.
So we've really imported new drug cartels, especially with the marijuana market.
Absolutely.
And the black market.
Absolutely. Black market is out of control.
So how is it best to manage and deal with the organized crime? What's the best way to do that? And I know that you worked also as a U.S. Marshal and got a real...
Because of people who didn't like me, weren't very happy about being in jail and taking away their stuff. There were often people who made threats. There were times when U.S. Marshals and FBI would be at our house or follow us around. So as part of self-protection, I was made a assistant deputy U.S. Marshal for purposes of personal protection, training, and firearms. And so that was just part of the job. I remember one case, I had to wear a bulletproof vest during trial, which was kind of fun.
Oh, wow. I don't think that'd be fun for me.
Well, I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie, so those kind of things are just kind of interesting to me.
It is interesting, but you definitely know you have a target on you if you need to wear a vest while in.
Yes, that's a very long story, but interesting.
So what's the best way? How do we deal with this? We're importing crime. The drug situation is out of control. It's not just, you know, China and Mexico, but we've got, you know, a whole bunch of international people in our land poisoning our children.
Yeah. Well, this answer may not surprise you, but it would surprise a lot of people coming from a career prosecutor. The best way to deal with it is to help people not use drugs. It's the customers that create the demand. If people didn't want drugs, didn't buy drugs, the cartels would go away. They wouldn't have customers. So I foremost in my mind is to educate and do prevention so that the number of users go down, the demand goes down, and there's less incentive for these people to be here. The second thing is the ones that do come here, we have to have enough resources to catch them, punish them, and take away their assets and make it very serious for them to do this. That requires a lot of resources. In states like Oregon, California, the resources are so overwhelmed. States that have legalized pot and become sharing drug proceeds with cartels, they've overrun those states to the point of people who have advocated these things, public officials, are now asking the feds to come in and help them because they can't deal with it. The national forests, the public lands, narco traffic, narco slavery, human trafficking, all of those things are part of it. And so we have to have strong law enforcement. We have to have support of law enforcement to do that. So it's both ends, but I would say the underlying way is teach our kids, and more importantly, adults, that these are choices they don't want to make, because everything bad happens as a result. There are no good things happen as a result of substance abuse.
I agree with you. Going upstream, primary prevention, decreasing the demand, teaching how to deal with emotions so you don't need to use drugs to fill those emotions when you have them at a very young age. So that's very important. I don't think we're doing enough of that as a country. But supply matters. It matters a lot, right? If there wasn't as much meth, there wasn't as, you know, wouldn't have as much cases in the emergency department with methamphetamine. Now it's freely pouring in across the border. And so when you have a lot of supply, it could just kill the primary prevention. And so I think that's really important.
Availability is a huge thing. The other thing is when a market is saturated with drugs, the price goes down. So you have greater availability, it's less expensive, and more people addicted, that increases demand. So all of those things factor in. Interesting thing that a lot of people don't think about is the drug lobbyists for years told us that if we legalized and regulated pot, that the cartels would be put out of business and that children wouldn't be able to get it. And those lies continue.
That was part of the many lies. Lies, kind of like the tobacco lies.
and they're the most obviously false. And you think after this many years, and there's so much proof of that, they wouldn't get away with that anymore. But they still do, because states don't learn from the history of other states. They just don't pay attention. Yeah. So something that most people don't understand is that part of the lie was that we were going to get rid of the black market, when in fact, when cartels began competing with states over drug proceeds, that's when the big move went to fentanyl and other opioids. They just chose to change their supply of those drugs, started pouring into the country. They're easier to smuggle in.
Say that again, Monty. What were you saying? What was the pivoting point in changing to fentanyl?
Yeah. As you well know, a lot of the opioid crisis was precipitated by pharmaceutical drugs and the abuse of those. Some people still believe that's the major thing, but that's not.
I don't think so. I think the prescription drug was definitely an issue.
Yeah.
10-20 year period where doctors were taught, I'm one of them, to overprescribe and got a lot of people addicted and sadly died from prescription drugs. That issue is over.
Yes.
It pales, totally. pales in comparison to fentanyl. I don't think the medical community caused the fentanyl crisis that we have.
In fact, but what people don't understand is the connection between legalization and that, because cartels deprived of some of their income just simply shifted to fentanyl. And when it became so easy to make fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, it was easier to traffic. It was easier to smuggle.
Than marijuana or prescription?
Marijuana, even other drugs at higher bulk. The purity of fentanyl, easier to bring in small quantities and make a lot of drugs, make a lot of profits. But then another very interesting thing happened. As the fentanyl started pouring in and saturating our streets, the cartels figured out that they could get right back into the marijuana business and thrive even better, because states that are saturated with pot, use goes up. It is prevalent everywhere. So they virtually could hide in plain sight because there was so much of it, and put their products into the stream of commerce. And they're competing against the legit pot industry, to the point states like California and Oregon are subsidizing recreational. You guys, California passed a $100 million bill to piece of legislation to subsidize the recreational medical pot industry. And then they started cutting back taxes and regulations because they can't deal, they can't compete with cartels that grow really good pot without the costs associated, without the regulations, and without taxes. Yeah. And so most of the pot grown and sold in California and other states is black market pot. We've actually...
That's what I thought. I thought all the black market pot, there's so much of it destroying the lands of California. I have a whole podcast about destroying the public lands of California by marijuana. And I can't imagine with all that growth that some of that is not being bought by the legal. Like, how do we know?
There's no question about that.
That they're buying, like they're selling a legitimate business, but I wonder if you trace those plants where they're coming from, if they're still not coming from the black market.
There's no doubt about that. In fact, when you think about it, if the retail businesses can't make a profit, what are they going to do? They're going to look for cheaper sources of supply. You probably know Murad Gabriel, who is now he was a scientist, an amazing guy, worked up in Humboldt County as a researcher, environmentalist researcher focusing on endangered species. He's now the head of the U.S. Forest Service marijuana safety eradication stuff. And he continues to do research on that. I was with him on some marijuana grows in your national forest last fall, and we were using a new mass spec, portable mass spec device that can identify pesticides, trace amounts of pesticides.
Wow, that's fascinating.
It's totally fascinating. But what we're learning is we used to go into grows. The guys would be dressed in camo, but no other protection. And they'd go in and they'd see cans of pesticides and sprayers and that, but they didn't really know much about it. But through Murad's research and the use of this device, they're able to detect trace amounts of very dangerous pesticides, such as carbofuran and others, that are banned in the United States because they're so dangerous. But every one of these grows, they are using these chemicals to spray all over them all the time, to prevent bugs and other things and wildlife. And because these pesticides get sucked into the plant, it goes through the entire plant into the soil, and the spraying pollutes the ground, pollutes the vegetation, goes into the water supply, which all goes downstream. And one of the many things that people don't know is, besides destroying the environment, they're putting out a product that is filled with nerve agents. And so the drug itself, and you are now adding to that very dangerous pesticides that are going throughout your body, including your brain. We have no idea of the short or long-term consequences of that.
So we know that marijuana plant has infections in them. And as a matter of fact, the CDC has an alert for people who are immunocompromised not to use smoked marijuana products because of especially the fungus risk with that. So I think that that's well known. I don't know if people are hearing it, but that's definitely well known. It's very frustrating how, I don't know if it's corruption, but I do believe some of our legislators are bought by the marijuana lobby. I saw it firsthand last year when we had a little bill in California wanting to put labels on marijuana products, like we have for alcohol, like we have tobacco. This is a psychoactive drug. The public needs to be aware of that. That's it. That's what we were asking for.
Yeah.
We had support from the medical associations, emergency doctors, pediatricians, OBGYNs, parents. We had testimony from parents, heart-wrenching testimony from parents who've lost their children to cannabis-induced psychosis and suicide. Yeah. It was killed. The bill was killed, not to be signed by the governor, not support. It was killed in assembly.
That's one of the most shocking things about all of this.
Right.
When governments are facilitating, aiding and abetting federal crimes, and that's one of the difficult things to understand is how government has become drug profiteers. Political corruption caused by that is one of the scariest things I know. It is corrupting public officials, entire governments. And so you saw the result of that. Something that shouldn't be a controversial thing. There's a huge attack against it. I just saw it yesterday on a fentanyl bill. We had lobbyists from Texas and Tennessee and a bunch of people in suits arguing that we shouldn't increase penalties for fentanyl. And so the political corruption is tremendous. But the warning thing,
that was supposed to be mom and apple pie, right?
Yeah. The warning thing, I'm working with the state right now, that basically the manufacturers, either the doctors don't have to warn, manufacturers don't have to label, their so-called cannabis pharmacies, which is just a made-up thing, don't have to put warnings. Their rule is that you should put warnings on labels that are applicable, if any. This is from their cannabis board, state-run cannabis board. Put warnings on these products, if any. That's it. And attempts to put greater realistic warnings on products is being met with complete just denial. And so this morning, I was getting some calls about this from one state. And I said, just look at the warning labels the FDA requires for Marinol. Just look at that.
Exactly. That's what I tell people. Just go to the FDA label for therapeutic medicinal Marinol at low potency. That's low potency.
Yes.
Not even the high potency stuff. Just read it.
Yes.
It's already there. You know, the risks of psychosis and mental health and drug interactions and, you know, a whole bunch of things.
That's so at a minimum,
you're saying that people are against prosecuting people for fentanyl dealing. Let's talk about that, because you have a lot of experience with, you know, as a prosecutor divvying just punishment. And what is just punishment? You have the low level dealer, someone who's addicted themselves. They're being, you know, I just had a podcast with a gentleman who himself was addicted and did terrible things that he admits to because his brain was hijacked from drugs, but he was obviously a low level person. Sure. He called himself, he was used like Kleenex. He was disposable. They're just using him. Is that, I mean, there may be some punishment. He said he needed some punishment, but he was very happy to get off with just a few years. So how do you tell?
Well, first of all, you look at the quantities being sold because that determines the seriousness of it. The type of drug being sold is important because, you know, there are drugs that are more dangerous than others. You look at whether the trafficking is fueled entirely by just trying to re-up their supply constantly, or it is driven by some type of profit motive. We rarely dealt with users, even small-time traffickers, any differently than as witnesses. We'd actually try to help get them in treatment, get them clean so that they could be good witnesses. And we only went after the bigger traffickers. And although we got help from the smaller people, that wasn't our target. So something you may be very interested in is I maintain a relationship with defendants that I prosecuted over the years, because they feel like I treated them fairly, saw them as humans and realized there should be consequences for what they did. A couple of weeks ago, I had a prior defendant who lives in Africa, works in Africa in the mining gemstone industry, prosecuted him 30 years ago. We've kept in contact. He messaged me, wanted to send me something, and it cost a lot to send from Africa. So I said, I want to pay you for at least the shipping. He said, Monty, no, I don't want that. What I'd like you to do is go down to the local NA thing in Boise and write them a check. Because in addition to being arrested, between that and being in NA, it saved my life. And this spring, I'm going to get my 30-year pin from NA. Oh. And he asked me to donate, which I am going to. How powerful is that? To me, it was so powerful that he saw his arrest and the need to get into NA to get clean as a life-saving thing.
I've run into that repeatedly, where when nothing else works, when nothing else is working, when the addiction is so strong that you're doing crime and things that you don't even want to do,
right,
because your brain is telling you you're going to die if you don't have these drugs, that having a time out in jail, an opportunity to get your brain clean, can make you think better and make better choices, and can save someone's life, like you mentioned.
It's an incentive that sometimes works where nothing else works.
So what are you running into in Idaho with this? People don't want any prosecution for any drugs, or are they not acknowledging?
We're just the opposite. We're just the opposite. We have the advantage of having leaders at all levels who are adamantly opposed to Idaho becoming Oregon, Washington, Colorado, California. We have people fleeing those states and coming here and filling up our highways, and because they see this as a refuge, as a safe place to come.
They're not bringing their California, Oregon policies to Idaho?
You know what? Originally, that was the biggest fear.
Yeah.
But a lot of the most passionate people against liberal drug policies we have are refugees from other states. They come here and they say, basically, one of the best lines I've heard is, we are from your future. Let us tell you what's going to happen.
Interesting.
And so a combination of strong leadership, awesome drug prevention programs, just the nature of Idahoans themselves and trying to protect a way of life. We have been labeled by the pot industry as the most hostile state in America for drug legalization.
I saw that. You had a report card. You sent me a report card of the United States. Yeah. And on the report card, there's a bunch of states. I don't remember. California was a C. And there are some East Coast cities with a B. Yeah. And Idaho had a big fat F. You got an F.
That was
Are you proud of your F?
Oh, absolutely. That was a grading on medical marijuana programs. So here's a really interesting thing. States that have wide open medical marijuana programs get C's and D's because it's not enough. These people are never happy. No matter how broad it is, they're not happy. So you have national organizations that give a state a C because they're not doing enough, although everybody can get a card.
Yeah. California has a C, and we're like, there's no one who doesn't have access to marijuana.
How ironic is that? But it just tells you that these people are profit driven. They're never going to stop. But we get F's in other ways too. Our governor gets an F, our legislature gets an F. But one advantage to that, and I'm so sad that other states don't get this, when politicians talk about passing laws to normalize drug use, and citizen governments allow voter initiatives to pick up steam to the point it looks like they'll get on the ballot. The national organizations, including the commercial pot industry, see that stake as vulnerable. That state is vulnerable. That's when the big money comes in. That's when they see that state as being worth a $12 million investment. And that's where states lose the battle. Well, in Idaho, our position has always been not here, not now, not ever. And everything that we do is to telegraph to those organizations that this is not a good place for your investment. Don't come here. And we have never had those kind of investments here. And because we either stop legislation at the beginning or stop initiatives before they even get enough signatures to get on the ballot. We've never had an initiative even reach the ballot because we stopped it at the
so Idaho is like an island refuge of no marijuana legalization, medical, all that's off the table. Does that make a difference to the population? I'm wondering if there's a study there, if we could, you know, you compare California, Oregon, and Colorado, where it's everything's okay compared to Idaho. Is a population of Idahoans, is that how you call yourself?
Idahoans.
Yeah. And do you have less addiction, less schizophrenia? Or does it just seep through the borders anyway? And it doesn't make a difference in terms of marijuana, but also fentanyl and other drug issues.
I would say Idaho is a beautiful state to live. So we really value, treasure public lands, recreation, families, children, all of that. It's a high priority. It's an awesome place. That's why everybody's moving here. So because of those things.
And cost of living.
Cost of living, although that's the refugees are causing that to go way up because of housing and that. But so how different is a community when you don't have pot dispensaries that are out in the open? How different is a state when you don't have politicians bragging about how much pot's being sold and how much money's being made?
But I'm wondering if you could show that you have, less use, less hospitalizations, less crime. You know, like we have a report card that we publish in San Diego on prescription drugs, opioids, right, methamphetamine, marijuana. I wonder if your report card, these are good report cards, would show better grades.
It is a great grades. Any use is not okay, and so we continue to struggle. But just to give you one example, if you look at the NSDUH figures every year, the rates of marijuana use in all categories, age categories, are half and more of our surrounding states.
There you go. So yes, the data is there.
Absolutely. So if you're a teenager in Oregon, there's double or more use. In the 18 to 25 category, which is, the numbers are just going crazy, less than half. And so you can see the comparison of the consequences of policies and laws and attitudes in those states. There's a direct correlation between use here. Now, is there influence on our people because of surrounding states? Absolutely. Because when you have dispensaries right across the border, I mean, they're lined up against our border. And when they advertise on radio and TV, that comes over into Idaho. They push their products and say, come to us. And so, yeah, it's a huge, because other states are doing stupid things. It's impacting us. That's one of the reasons there's no reason to have a lack of uniformity in drug laws, because you can't stop this at the border. What other people do, and people say, well, states have rights to do things that other states do. Well, that's not true uniformly. We don't have the right to dump nuclear waste in the Snake River that borders Oregon just because we want to save money. There's laws against that. But because we don't enforce federal laws, all states, including states like Idaho, get impacted negatively.
Very interesting. But I love that analogy. I think that could be like a little a meme, you know, like you don't have recreational or medical and you have less, 50% less of youth using drugs. I think that's worth it.
Oh, it's worth everything. I mean, yeah. What if you quantify the amount of misery, if you could put a dollar figure on the amount of misery that's caused by one person you love coming under the influence of drugs, you couldn't calculate that. And when it involves a death, let alone addiction. But I like to refer to Idaho as an island of sanity in a sea of insanity. Yeah. And
you're fighting a big industry. How is that going? Is that threatening? Do you need to wear your bulletproof vest?
No, I don't worry about that. Although my wife has often noted that the drug traffickers I used to prosecute are less dangerous than those people. And there's a lot of truth to that. There is, it'd be hard to explain, but...
Wait, the marijuana dealers are more dangerous, or the marijuana industry is more dangerous than the drug cartels you were prosecuting?
The people advocating the normalization of drugs in all forms, maybe not necessarily person to person, but the people pushing that and creating a lot of corruption in government is dangerous to people who are fighting it. We've got people who volunteer their life to educate people are getting, or you talk to Alex Berenson, for example, he gets death threats because of what he dares say about marijuana and violence and other things. It's a huge problem, but has to be done. If we give up, where are we? We give up generations. We other states have lost a quality of life that they will never regain because of decisions are made. We view Idaho as a place to retain, maintain, and protect that quality of life. And we're doing it because we have great leadership.
Interesting. And yet you still have a drug problem, right? Like nothing is perfect. And you have drug courts where you give people second chances?
Yeah, very important here. Obviously, if we could get everyone into treatment, if we could get every child to understand choices and consequences and not have their governors cheerleading the latest bot figures and income, tax revenue, if we could, but a lot of people think we got to just fix the kids. I'm often asked to get a call from some city in Florida and they want me to come. And I'll say, okay, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, we want you, basically what it comes down to is we want you to come and fix our kids. And I say, okay, I could do that, but do you think that a little bald-headed guy from Boise, Idaho is going to come and talk to your kids for an hour and fix the problem? And they nervously say, well, no. I said, you really want to fix the problem? Yeah. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk to the kids, but unless you can promise me you can get a significant group of community stakeholders together so that I can talk to them, I'm not coming, because if adult behavior does not change, we could fix every kid in America. We'd still have a tremendous drug problem. So instead of coming for an hour to a school assembly, I talked to the adults and I said, look, this is what we're facing. You people that are making policies, laws, and budgets have to understand what these things are doing to your communities, your kids, your adults, and you have to change behavior. You have to wake up. And it's a pretty tough talk. And so we talked to them. That's very important. Talk to the kids. I love going to alternative schools or even juvenile detention facilities because those kids get it. They're more receptive than the average high school audience. They
really, they don't blow you off like, I don't know what you're talking about.
I wish I had time, doctor, to tell you about going to the most serious juvenile detention facility in the state and having 13 young ladies that are in there for serious crimes, most of them addicted to some type of opioid, ages 13 to 17, came in orange coveralls and basically sat there like this when I started talking. And because I didn't talk to them about drugs, I talked to them about their value, their potential, that they were infinite, they had infinite worth, and that was inside them. They opened up, body language opened up. Before it was done, everyone except one was in tears, including myself. And all they needed to do is understand they have value no matter what's happened to them, no matter what they've done. They still have the potential for a wonderful life. And that was a message that I don't usually do, but in that case, that was the case. So my whole day gets filled up. And it goes from those schools, alternative schools, juvenile detention, community stake leaders, and usually in the evening, we'll find a big church and talk to the faith community, because you can get more people at a church on a given night than 4 months of advertising to get parents at a high school on a Thursday night to listen about to drugs. You can have hundreds of people come and the school will get 10. And so I found that to be a very effective way to reach the most people at one time. My days are really filled. I love it. I love every minute of it.
And so you talk to youth and you tell them that they have worth and help them make right decision.
Yeah.
You talk to community leaders and you tell them you need to change your policies. Do you have like a list of these are some policies you can take up in your community?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me your list.
You can't just tell them the problems and not offer solutions.
Right.
So I learned a long time ago that you can talk to people and they can hear through their ears and maybe their brain will even process it. But unless it gets them here, unless they understand in a very deep way why these things matter, they're not motivated to change anything. So you can't just give them information. You have to help them feel a sense of urgency. If they don't feel that, nothing will change. So in describing the problems that are occurring, and a lot of times these meetings happen after I've been meeting with their kids during the day. And I don't tell them stuff that happened in Idaho. I tell them the things their children are telling them. And the solutions are, we have to change adult behavior, number one. We have to change
What do you mean by that?
Adults can't be promoting, accepting, normalizing, using drugs. And that means substance abuse of all kinds.
Don't you resist that? I'm just seeing doctors, nurses, professionals using drugs.
No, I understand. But the solution is for them not to. And to model behavior that this is not okay. That's one thing.
Yeah.
Other thing is they need to know is they need to put a tremendous amount of time and effort into youth all kinds of education and prevention. If they're not doing that, they're not going to change anything.
Absolutely.
They need to put money into recreational programs, things for kids to do. most schools don't have any kind of effective drug prevention. They think that having a two-week class during freshman year in health about drugs fixes the problem, which it never does. They think having one red ribbon speaker a year is sufficient education to keep their kids away from drugs. So you talk about those kind of things, policies, budgets, laws, attitudes. And in the end, they have a list of things that they should be doing. Some of them do, some don't. And then you talk to kids about it. And one of my most favorite things is talking to youth leadership groups. And it's amazing because when you express a belief in youth to change things and you give them this, the idea of how powerful their influence could be on their peers and even adults and in their community, and you give them some tool, first encourage them, teach them how to do that, they can be a powerful force that we can't be because they're doing it peer to peer. And it's a miraculous thing to watch.
Yeah, that's important. You know, one source, I don't know if you're aware of, I had a whole couple podcasts on this, on the issue of prevention science and blueprints for healthy youth. So I don't know, because that would be a great resource when you go for schools who want to implement a program and they say, oh, the DARE program didn't work. Well, here's 100 other programs that do work.
Sure. So yeah. I usually bring a resource list of the groups that I admire and know they're doing good things that are more concerned about actually impacting behavior than parachuting in to give a talk and thinking that's enough. So all of those resources, I think because of my experience as a prosecutor, I have the ability to speak with authenticity on choices and consequences. It's not a talk about drugs. It's a talk about choices we make and good and bad consequences. And I can use examples from my career to illustrate what happens when you make bad choices. And I did that for years.
Give us one example.
Well, okay. So to have any credibility with kids, you first have to establish credibility that you know what you're talking about, but more importantly, that you care. That takes a while because you have to break down barriers of apathy, denial, all of those things. And most kids will come into a high school auditorium saying, this is a stupid drug talk. We're not going to listen to this guy. They're not serious about it. So I start out just talking to him about things I've seen, homicide scenes, children that have been killed, addicts that have ruined their lives. And it gets very serious very quickly. And it's not a scare tactic. It's a heartfelt thing that this is why I care. The other thing you have to establish is that you care about them. You're not there because somebody's paying you, or that somebody's going to check off a list of things they have to do that year, red ribbon or whatever. You have to establish that you care about them as a group and individually. And one of the best things I love to do is, as people come in, I love to talk to as many kids as I can before I start. I want to shake their hands. I want to look in their eyes, ask them their names, help them understand that I care about them. And once you establish those two things, credibility on the subject and a true interest in their welfare, they listen more. And it gets very serious. And I love it. It's the best thing. I wish, if I could have one wish, it would be I didn't have to spend so much time dealing with bad people who are trying to normalize drugs. It takes a lot of my time. I'd much rather spend it with communities and kids and do that. But yeah, these bad people consume a lot of our time.
And Sarah asked us a question about hookah. Before I get to that, I want you to tell us about the circumstances that led you to photography, because you use wildlife photography in your speech, and I don't think people know about that.
Well, even though I'm a very optimistic person, after 30 years in law enforcement and seeing carnage every day, I woke up one day, this after the kids were off to college or married, and it's a different world then. I found myself waking up depressed. I found myself being out in society and seeing the dark things and thinking, oh, the world's terrible. This scared me because it wasn't my nature to think that way. So I decided I knew I needed another outlet to change this kind of hunkered down attitude I had. And so I bought a cheap camera, and it changed me, because instead of being like this, with a camera in my hand, what do you think I was doing? I was looking for everything that is beautiful and unique and wonderful. And so my world kind of started to be like this. And I'm going, whoa, I've been missing all of this for years. And that changed me, because I started to appreciate all the wonderful things. And that included paying attention to kids laughing and all the things I used to pay attention to. And so through photography, I healed myself. But more importantly, instead of finishing a drug talk with the bad news, I spend a great deal of time at the end sharing my story of how I rediscovered joy in my life by noticing all the wonderful things in the universe, beauty, nature, wildlife, opportunities, adventure, infinite things to learn, but then sharing what I've seen. And that starts out with little tiny macro pictures that are fascinating, little tiny, to bigger things, to pets, to animals, to people's faces. And ultimately, it's vast, beautiful sunsets. And wildlife photography, I just got back from Alaska, where I shot pictures of grizzly bears for a week, it was like living in Jurassic Park in the wilderness and Kodiak Island. We'd wake up in the morning and be 9 grizzly bears along the river catching salmon. It was just amazing.
Awesome.
Or cougars in a wild mountain lions in a tree. And so all of this building up to, this is the planet you live on. And if you go further out in space, you see this, until you've got nebulas and billions of stars. And I say, at the end of that, with all of these things around us, how could we ever be bored? How could we ever be bored? We live in a world that has infinite possibilities and a universe. And it's an alternative. It's not to just say no, it's to say yes. And to adults, my final message is usually that the world of drugs takes a person from all of this and narrows their universe further and further and further until their universe is this. That's their friend, that's their social circles, that's their comforter, that's even like their religion. And our greatest thing that we could do for those people is to free them from this and get them to look at all the other things they could do that are infinitely more fascinating and satisfying than anything the drug culture can bring them.
That's absolutely beautiful, Monte. You start your talks with the heinousness of a child being murdered. And that analogy, also how you got yourself out of depression. Depression is a very selfish disease. So to get out of depression, you need to look out. And that's what you did with your camera. Yeah. That's beautiful.
And I love ending that way. In fact, I love doing a whole talk on that. But you have to start out by helping them understand, this is a problem. Here's one of many solutions.
Yeah.
That's very satisfying. I love it. Wish I could do it every day.
So Sarah is a pharmacy student. She very energetic, outgoing. She had a question about hookah. People come to her when you're, you know, when you're a medical professional, all your family comes to you and friends. Yeah. It's like they ask you for your advice. Is hookah safer than cannabis? What do you think? What's your
answer? Depends on what you're smoking through hookahs. We have very little of that here. Some people say when they use
no hookah bars in Idaho.
No, we if you. Because it's illegal. Well, I guess they can smoke
depends tobacco. What's in it, right?
Yeah. So it's basically the idea of a hookah, as I understand it, is it just bubbles, whatever it is, bubbles through water or something. And so it kind of cleans it out. But it's just a question of how many bad things you get in you. If it inebriates you, if it makes your brain and body not work, there's nothing good about that. So it's like saying, well, filtered cigarettes are good for you and unfiltered is not. It's a silly idea.
Yeah, interesting. You know, it's funny because I was thinking about Sarah and her hookah question. Just last night, I was up late last night. I saw a patient treated with asthma and I gave her breathing treatments and prednisone. And I always ask every patient, do you smoke, drink, or use drugs? And she said, no, I don't do any of that. I just hookah. And I'm like, uh-huh. And you're putting that stuff in your lung and you're here with an asthma attack. That's not a good thing. I did a little research for Sarah. Hookah is a water pipe used to smoke tobacco or herbal products. And it can be addictive, just like nicotine's addictive. Yeah. And when you smoke hookah, you also have carbon monoxide, carcinogens, heavy metals, tars, not so good. And smoking anything. I don't care what you're smoking. Yeah. It's not good for your lungs.
And a lot of it's weed too. So
it could be weed. And you're also producing secondhand smoke effects, just like cigarettes. Yeah. So Sarah, what's safer, a hookah or vaping? That's also actually researched that. Is it safer to smoke a hookah or a vaping? And I didn't see any major differences. And what's safer, hookah or cannabis? It's like asking, what's safer, tobacco or marijuana? Monty, what's safer, tobacco or marijuana?
Tobacco will kill you over a long period of time, and it's addictive, and it screws up people's lives, and they waste a lot of money. Marijuana makes you immediately inebriated. Your judgment is impaired. You can die in the first day because you drive off the road and kill yourself. The consequences are much worse. And the long-term consequences aren't just cancer and you get sick and die. It's damage to your brain, your learning abilities, your motivation. There's so many additional consequences, emotionally, mentally, physically, all of that. There's no question in my mind.
Yeah.
Tobacco kills you eventually, makes you less sick, but pot is, especially we didn't legalize a crude plant. We commercialized THC. That's the product. Yeah. So that's what's in demand. So
tobacco has a risk of lung cancer, heart disease, emphysema. We know that tobacco is a risk factor for a heart attack. Not everybody who smokes is going to get a heart attack, but it's a significant risk factor. And marijuana has a risk of psychosis, testicular cancer. People don't know that. Your risk of testicular cancer is more than twofold if you're a marijuana user. And smoking anything has a lung risk. Just like tobacco with heart disease, if you use THC regularly, you have a risk of schizophrenia. Not everybody who uses marijuana is going to get schizophrenia, right, but it's a risk factor. So both tobacco, nicotine, and marijuana, THC, have risks, different risks. Both are not healthy. So I hope that helps Sarah.
And greater risk. Question. And if you add things to that that people don't even know about, like nerve agents in the stuff they're smoking, that we have no idea what it's doing to people.
Right. All the different contaminants in there that's hurting yourself and the lands, right?
Exactly. Environmentalists should be up in arms if they knew what was happening.
Yeah. And some are.
Some are hope getting that. Yeah.
So I want to say thank you to Sarah for your question, and I want to wish you the best of luck in your studies to become a pharmacist. It's a very rich career with many possibilities, and you are off to an amazing start. And Monty Stiles, thank you so much for your expertise, your career of service, and now continuing to give back to your state and to your country.
Thank you, Dr.
And to the kids in the future.
Yeah, the kids. Thank you for what you do. You're awesome. You're a hero of mine, so keep it up.
Oh, thanks.
You bet.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors educating on the harms of marijuana. Visit isaic1.org, that's ISIC1.org, to view their library that translates medical journals for public understanding, listen to their speaker series, and follow the science on marijuana. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.